is R&R Express, Mr. Rose.
May it please the court, that's K&R Express, Your Honor.
K&R, I'm sorry.
My name is Ken Roth, and I represent K&R, the appellant and cross-appellee in this case, and the defendant in this Title VII ADEA case. In December 1997, about 2 weeks after Magistrate Judge Keyes granted K&R summary judgment in the Filipovic 1 case, Mr. Filipovic filed a new charge in the EEOC, which the EEOC eventually dismissed and resulted in this lawsuit. By the time the district court got it on summary judgment, three issues were, and after the district court granted K&R partial summary judgment, three issues were left for trial. First was a retaliation claim. Mr. Filipovic alleged that over the 2 years following the filing of his EEOC charge, he received 7 disciplinary letters from K&R for the offense of mishandling freight. His second charge was that he was discriminated against on account of his Yugoslavian national origin because he was disciplined more harshly than other K&R dockmen for similar offenses. His third claim was that he was denied the position of spotter, which is a guy that moves trailers through the shipping yard through, from dock bay to dock bay on account of his age.
Mr. Ross, can I ask you, with respect to his retaliation claim, the district court thought that Mr. Filipovich's assertion that all of the problems cited in the various letters that were sent to him were simply fabrications, and I realize that it's your position that that's just not enough to make even a jury issue out of it. But what do you think he needed to do? What should he? What's missing in your view?
Well, two things, Your Honor. One that goes to the fact of guilt or innocence on each of those charges, which would go to the question of whether or not he was meeting the company's legitimate freight handling expectations. The other goes to actually a subjective issue, the good faith or bad faith of the individual who issued him the warning.
It seems to me he was partially saying that these kinds of slippages occurred all the time and only he was being singled out for these disciplinary letters.
Oh, I don't think he ever said that, John. I don't think he ever said
you
that.
Think
I think
missing
what he simply said.
Yeah.
I think what he simply said was that I didn't do it. Obviously, something more than a recitation of your allegation in the complaint. Your allegation in the complaint has to be I was meeting the legitimate expectations of my employer, and something other than I wasn't not meeting the legitimate expectations of my employer is required. I think he would have to show that he would have had to give him some testimony, for example, where 2 pieces of freight were found on the loading dock. He would have had to testify, and I think this would have created an issue. You know, I recall those 2 pieces of freight, and I put them on the trailer. And I'll tell you, maybe he could elaborate. I put them on the trailer in the left-hand corner. Or he could simply say, I knew exactly those 2 pieces of freight. I recall loading them. He never even said that. He simply said, I made no mistake. He offered no explanation when the company said, you know, after you recorded on your manifest that you loaded those pieces, we found it the next day sitting on the loading dock.
On the dock or in Niles or in wherever else
right.
It was found.
And these are common mistakes. I mean, there's no question of good faith or bad faith. There's no issue here as to whether or not he's doing this on purpose. It happens a lot. K&R put in an exhibit of 140 other letters that were issued to Dockman during that period. It's a fast-moving operation. It's a time-intensive operation, and mistakes are made. And the purpose of the progressive disciplinary policy, like any progressive disciplinary policy, isn't to punish, but rather to educate. Say, look, you made this mistake. You're going to have to be more careful. And by the way, 7 over the course of 2 years isn't all that horrible of a record.
Now, he still works for K&R, or at least at the time of this trial, did?
At the time of the trial, he did, Your Honor.
Now, this all culminated in a 2-day suspension, is that correct?
That is the only real harm that he suffered. After he got the first letter, came about 5 months after he filed the EEOC charge. Second letter came roughly I think about 9 months after the EEOC charge, but two or three after he filed the lawsuit. The third letter, under the progressive disciplinary policy, you get two warning letters. The third letter would be a letter of suspension. He was suspended. He lost 2 days' pay. He lost $300. He grieved that suspension to his union. A neutral grievance panel of the union made of three employees, three union members, and three management members, none of whom could be from K&R. They have to be from other members of the council who signed the collective bargaining agreement, from other trucking companies. Upheld his grievance on the evidence that was presented to the grievance committee. I'm sorry. Upheld K&R's suspension.
Right. $300.
After that, he did get two more suspension letters in late 1999, following the progressive disciplinary policy, following some warnings.
But in the meantime, this case is rolling along in the district court.
Yeah. In fact, it's interesting because none of the original charges that were part of the EEOC charge, with the exception of the spotter claim, of the age discrimination and employment claim, were really part of the EEOC charge. But that wasn't really an issue because if we started yelling exhaustion, first of all, I think this court has held that if after you've exhausted your EEOC remedy, there's additional actions during the course of trial, those should be included and amended, and it would have been a huge waste of time.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, as the trial was rolling along, the case was going to litigation, these other charges, these other disciplinary letters were issued. The one in October 1999, which is almost 2 years after his EEOC charge, K&R unilaterally would reduce to a final warning letter. This is a common practice in labor negotiations. Shop steward will come in and say, you know, you're being a little rough on the guy, he's got a lot of experience, you know, we're going to make a grievance of it, and it's a cost-effective analysis. The employer might say, you know what, it's not worth going to grievance, okay, we'll drop it down to a final warning. The last one was a suspension, and the suspension did not stick. He grieved the suspension December 1999. Now, this is 2 years after the EEOC charge.
This is one where we're debating whether December 3rd is a Friday or a Saturday?
Yeah, that's the one. That's the
okay.
One. Kind of, it was kind of an interesting debate at trial.
Okay.
Trump, but I mean, didn't the judge just tell, you know, you look in a calendar and you... It's not a jury issue.
It wasn't a jury issue, Jeff. It wasn't a jury issue. Which, and I'm not quite sure that the jury, I can't speculate on what the jury did, but I do know what the district court did as far as whether or not Mr. Filipovic was meeting the company's legitimate expectations. I think this is the major flaw in the district court's opinion. Judge Lefkoe looked at the evidence and she said, look, he may or may not have done these things. He may or may not have made those mistakes, but that goes to pretext. And he could prove pretext through direct evidence. He could prove pretext through evidence of K&R's motive. He could show, for example, there was evidence that K&R tried to influence the EEOC investigation by issuing and then withdrawing a warning letter for absenteeism. There was evidence that Mr. Filipovic was a good worker. She said that he could prove pretext that way. Don't worry about the actual charges. And that's the problem. The district court never looked to see whether or not, never analyzed whether or not he was meeting the legitimate freight handling expectations of his employer.
Well, actually, I mean, both sides have briefed this as though we're still frozen in these paradigms that are used to decide whether summary judgment's appropriate. We're here after a trial, rightly or wrongly. I mean, there was certainly a trial in this case. And whether there's pretext or whether there's meeting a legitimate expectations, we're focusing on the ultimate issue, right? What if this man retaliated against on this part of the case, of course.
And that's what Millbrook says you have to do, Joe.
Right.
But
yeah.
The thing about Millbrook is it also says he could prove his case. He could prove his case even post-trial by showing that he met all his elements of a prima facie case plus pretext.
Well, I would put it differently. I would say if a rational trier of fact could have found that the employer was lying about what it was doing, was engaged in the kinds of behaviors that we have labeled as pretext, that is evidence. The Supreme Court's made this clear and in lots of different cases as well, Reeves among others. That's evidence that would support a trier of fact finding that the ultimate discrimination, or in this instance retaliation, occurred. I don't think it's that the pretext itself has any meaning on its own, but one can infer, a jury could rationally infer,
right,
the violation.
Only, but under Millbrook, only if he shows his prima facie case.
I don't think so. I think he has to show that the employer was lying about what it did.
I believe that if he doesn't show that he was meeting the legitimate freight expectation, the legitimate employment expectation of his employer, then whether the employer was lying or not.
Your argument was just the jury verdict is irrational.
My argument
because
is
because he admitted most of these violations. He got a bunch of letters, and then a little tiny suspension. I don't know why.
It is. Your Honor, that is one of my arguments.
The prima facie cases, it just seems crazy as far as I can see. I don't get it.
My argument is that it is an irrational verdict. And focusing on the suspension, in Filipovic 1, now granted that was before Stone versus City of Indianapolis, but in Filipovic 1, the court said, look, when you have a big time lag between the protected conduct and the adverse action, and you have the adverse action affirmed by a neutral union procedure. And I think the Sixth Circuit said the same thing in the Kaneda case, which we also cite. As a matter of law, you can't show causation. Now, causation has a limited impact after Stone. Causation is no longer part of a prima facie case in an indirect evidence case. It is part of a case, and it is a required element of a direct evidence case. So to the extent that this plaintiff says, I'm making a direct evidence case, as a matter of law, I think he fails on causation.
Well, once again, I mean, I would suggest that none of this matters. Ultimately, to win, a plaintiff has to prove causation. Now, the plaintiff can do so inferentially through indirect mechanisms, and the point of Stone was we can't destroy the indirect mechanism of going forward, I would say, as opposed to what you ultimately, but I don't believe this court has ever held that at the end of the day, a plaintiff can hold a defendant liable for something that the defendant had nothing to do with.
Well, absolutely, Judge.
That doesn't come out of Stone.
And I'm not suggesting it does. A retaliation case is still, we acted against this guy because
he
engaged in protection.
Why don't you save the rest of your time for rebuttal?
Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, Mr. Leonard.
Good morning. May it please the Court. Michael Leonard on behalf of Mr. Filipovic. Judge Wood, I think that you framed this quite adequately, except
mean,
I think it's...
You mean she agrees with you? Is that...
Exactly, Judge.
Well, or hope I do.
We'll see about that. but I think the question is, with a little spin on it, is what more could Mr. Filipovic have
well,
done?
Well, look, I'm looking now at page 6 of Judge Lefkoe's Rule 50B argument in the appendix here, the tab A. Look at Rule, left-hand column, top paragraph. She says, she says, the jury had sufficient evidence based on what was presented to conclude that these infractions never took place. Now look at the preceding page, where he admits all these. And Filipovic admits this infraction, admits, union upheld. Filipovic, let me look at the last thing at the bottom of page 5 at the right about the Friday-Saturday business. He testified the trailer was unloaded on a Saturday when his shift ended at 1:30. But December 3rd was a Friday. So I don't understand what on earth she could have meant.
Well, Judge, respectfully, I think that's a very broad characterization of what the testimony was. I would concede
I'm
that.
I'm asking you what Judge Lefkoe is talking about.
I think what
she obviously thinks that he admitted some of the infractions he admitted, some are undeniable, that they're based on the calendar. And how does she end up saying that the jury could have found that these infractions never took place? which she regards as the essential proof that Filipovich is making. These infractions were fabrications by K&R. I don't get that.
Well, I think your language and her language, you're deciding her language, it's a broad sweep. I mean, he did make certain admissions.
Her language, my language, what are you talking about?
Well, what I'm
saying. She says the evidence is, the jury concluded, enough evidence concluded that these infractions never took place. Now, are you going to defend that proposition?
Yep.
None of the infractions ever took place? They're all fabrications?
Absolutely, Judge, and here's why.
Oh, okay.
Here's what happened at trial, Judge. On direct examination, admittedly, Mr. Filipovich's explanation of what happened was very succinct, a denial.
He had no explanation at all. That's the problem.
Well, no,
he didn't even say, you know, somebody snuck onto the premises at night, or it was really supposed to go to Niles, or, I mean, he just said, no, I don't know, I have no idea. How is that an explanation? That was what I was trying to get at from your opponent's point of view, but I really actually have the same question for you. Shouldn't he have maybe testified that practice as to the responsibilities of a loader isn't to note all these details on the form that K&R says they were supposed to note, or that actually it didn't make any difference if it was a Friday or a Saturday, or, you know, something other than just no.
Well, that's what I was getting to, Judge. He didn't just say no. On direct examination, he did succinctly state he didn't do things. However, counsel for K&R made a tactical trial decision to instead of accepting that and relying upon that, and I agree, if that had been the only testimony, we might not be here today. But what they did then is go spend about 5 hours going to minutia on cross-examination of each and every episode. And within that, it is not true that he gave unequivocal admissions that, yes, I did all these things. That's not true.
Did he give explanations?
He did.
Okay, what would be an example of an explanation?
An example would be when the freight was supposed to go to one place for another, the sticker wasn't on there, but that was not his responsibility, and he did not screw that up, so to speak, Judge. There were other examples. If you look at his testimony.
Well, let's look at the examples that Judge Lefkoe looked at.
Sure. She looked at these letters, and he either gave a denial of engaging in that conduct. And when he gives a denial of engaging in the conduct then, Judge, the record is unrefuted in terms of what happened. So we have to accept his version of events unless they offer some rational explanation to the contrary.
But how can a jury, let's look at this Cincinnati thing at the bottom of page 5, where the trailer arrives in Cincinnati one piece short. And he says, I see that from the document. And the question is, do you have any reason to think the document's false? And he says, basically, yes, it was falsified. But how is that enough to permit a jury to conclude that it's false when the company has shown that the missing piece of freight is sitting there in Hinsdale?
Well, Judge, what they didn't show is that after Mr. Filipovich was done, that the trailer then remained open. The inference is anyone could have moved the piece or failed to put it on the truck. He says, I did it, I put it there, and they don't have anything to counter that, Judge.
Well, he said it was a fabricated document, a falsified document.
Because he didn't do it. I mean,
he said the document was false. What's that about?
Well, the document's false.
Paranoid.
Well, no, he's not, Judge.
No, he said it was fabricated by K&R management.
Judge, he's not a very articulate gentleman.
No, he's perfectly articulate. He's perfectly articulate.
But the point he was making.
Fantastic.
No, the point he was making, Judge, it's a fabricated.
And also, what is your theory? Your theory is that, or his theory is, K&R management is engaged in this incredible scheme to make up phony disciplinary letters so it can suspend him for 2 days after several years? What kind of scheme of retaliation is that?
Well, that's not exactly how it went down, Judge.
Doesn't make any sense.
Here's what actually happened, Judge. If you look at the 2-year time period before he filed the charge, he was issued one letter. He was never suspended on any occasions. If you look at the 2 years after he filed this, he was issued 9 letters and suspended 3 times, Judge.
What did he say? What did he mean when he testified? So by your testimony, K&R was treating you worse before you filed your EEOC charge than after you filed. And he says, of course.
Judge, if I can explain that. He testified, and it's in the record, specifically on his redirect examination. Mr. Ross asked him about a period of time, because there was this other litigation. Mr. Ross tried to compare this other litigation time period to the 1997-1999 term period. The only issue in terms of time period that's relevant is the 2 years or so before his filing of a charge in December of 97, and the 2 years after. I asked him specifically, compare your treatment in the 2 years prior to filing a charge in December of 97 to the 2 years after. He specifically delineated how, in the 2 years preceding, he'd received one letter, never been suspended. After he filed this, he's issued 9 letters and suspended 3 times, Judge. The judge also found, Your Honor, that within 7 or 8 days of filing the charge, they issue him a letter, a disciplinary letter for mishandling of freight. They then, by HR's own admission...
No, I thought the letter that he got immediately after the charge was about showing up late, that he doesn't get a letter about freight mishandling until 5 months in.
Well, whatever the substance of that January 8th letter, Judge...
Well, which wasn't about mishandling.
But the judge did find, and the jury was allowed to infer, based upon what the HR representative testified to at trial, that they retracted the letter... And
where did the judge find that?
The judge found it in her opinion. She stated that the jury could have concluded that they tried to interfere with the investigatory process of the EEOC.
That's in the punitive damages section of the opinion?
Correct.
Yeah.
And what happened, in essence, there was he files a charge in December of 97. HR representative admits at trial he received it, gives it to everybody, including the president of the company, and then he admits they retract it for purposes of sending it to the EEOC so they can show, in response to one of my questions, what good guys they are. They then, when the EEOC concludes their investigation in May, immediately issue him another letter for a different basis. They then follow that up with 2 letters, all which have to precede the suspension. It's not a crazy concocted scheme, Judge. To get a suspension under these rules, you have to issue all these predicate factual disciplinary letters. You can't simply go to a suspension. You can't simply go to a termination. All these intervening steps are relevant, and they have to do it to enable them to suspend or terminate an employee. And that's exactly what they did. And there was ample evidence of pretext here. And I want to give you 4 or 5 examples.
But how can there be if it's not enough for him simply to say it's all fabricated, which is, you know, just if that's the characterization at least the judge puts on this record, then how is it a problem for the company to point out to him ways in which his performance isn't satisfying them, missing pieces of freight and misdirected pieces of freight?
I would agree with you if he offered no explanation, but he did. During extensive 4 to 5 hour cross-examination testimony, they went through each of these things, and he did make...
Well, you haven't given a good example yet.
A good example is the stickers going from supposedly supposed to be on the box or the freight. Mr. Filipovich's testimony was that it wasn't his responsibility, it was somebody else's.
But your opponent said it wasn't his responsibility to put the stickers on, but it was his responsibility to note on the form that there were missing stickers.
Well, he disagreed with that, Judge. I mean, as to each of these incidents, he differed.
I mean, he disagrees.
He says that's not the policy. That wasn't his responsibility. He didn't have to note it.
Why is he competent to testify that wasn't the policy, maybe not the practice?
He's the guy who does the job on a daily basis. Certainly, if he offers testimony and says, this is not the policy, this is not the practice, this is not the procedure, I didn't do that, Judge, it's then the burden of the company to come forward with some, at least a scintilla of evidence, to refute that. And they didn't do it. What they did in response, they didn't call anybody who wrote these disciplinary letters. They didn't call anyone who was present on any of these occasions. Instead, what they did was proffer a union representative to say, hypothetically, if a certain set of facts happened, would the company be justified?
What's wrong with that?
More evidence than Mr. Phil Pope?
What is wrong with that? If the union agrees about what the company has a certain policy, why isn't that good evidence?
Because he has no first-hand knowledge of the episodes. He has no disciplinary responsibility.
But that's not the
question.
He's
a rank and file employee like
Mr.
Phil Pope.
They're posing to the union person, what's the policy in this workplace? You know, for example, you could say hypothetically, if somebody shows up to work 30 minutes late, do they have their pay docked or do they get a disciplinary letter? And that would be a generic workplace policy that would be independent of what any particular worker did on a particular day. Isn't that what the union representative was testifying to?
Well, no, he wasn't. He was presented with facts and by KR's counsel to say, if these were the set of facts, what would you have done, or would
right,
it be appropriate for management?
Right, if these were the set of facts, is this the kind of thing that disciplinary letters can be written about?
Well, why is he any more confident than Mr. Filipovic to testify to negate Mr. Filipovic's testimony?
Because
when
say he runs the grievance system, because the union people decide which charges to go forward with.
The union people don't rule upon discrimination. They don't even address it. And in fact, he admitted during his trial testimony that he did nothing.
What are you talking about discrimination for? The union people decide what the workers' responsibilities are for performing their jobs. You know, they decide when the employer has stepped outside the boundaries and when the employer hasn't.
If that was the case, Judge, then they would have reversed all these decisions, which they didn't do. They did reverse a couple of the suspensions, but they did not reverse the suspension at issue. In addition, I think pretext is relevant here because we've shown Mr. Filipovic offered some evidence to show that he didn't commit the infractions, that the facts were not undisputed.
Well, how about the Friday-Saturday infraction? Surely he can't deny that, can he?
Well, Judge, if you have the wrong date of the event and he says he wasn't present, I think he could deny it.
No, he testified that he left at 1:30 because it was Saturday. Now, it turns out December 3rd, 1999 was Friday. How then can you stand here and deny that he failed to unload the freight if he was before his shift ended?
Well, he still said he unloaded the freight.
Excuse me?
He still stated that he unloaded the freight. When he gets done with his job of loading or unloading, there's testimony that the trucks are still.
No, he failed, a piece of freight was not unloaded. And he said that he didn't do that because he had left already since it was after 1:30, because it was Saturday. But it wasn't Saturday.
There was no testimony, Judge, to refute the fact whether it was Friday, Saturday, or Monday that he left.
But he said he left because it was Saturday. If it was Friday, he'd have to have another reason for leaving, wouldn't
he?
Well,
Judge, if he was mistaken on the date, I don't think it happened.
If he's mistaken on the day, he's mistaken on the time.
Well, no. Why isn't the company, if that was somehow false, Judge, wouldn't the company have a time record to rebut that? They didn't offer any evidence to rebut it. Once he proffers a reason that is legitimate,
no, the reason isn't legitimate. The reason is fantastic. He thinks Saturday is Friday. He thinks Friday is Saturday. How can that be the evidence?
So, Judge, he makes a mistake.
It shifts the burden of production to the other side.
He makes a mistake on which day he was there and states unequivocally that he left at a certain time. And you're
no,
gonna
he
tell
said
me
unequivocally it was Saturday. That's why he left.
Well, he also said unequivocally
that he
left.
It isn't clear that he remembers what time he leaves every day years earlier. People don't remember the hour they left. They remember that they don't work, you know, Saturday afternoon. So if it's Saturday, they know they left early.
Well, I think if that was untrue in any way, Judge, it would be very easy for the company to rebut it with a time record.
It was untrue.
Well, I don't agree with you, Judge. And I think to take statements out of context when he was cross-examined for 4 to 5 hours on each event is unfair, and it doesn't create an accurate picture
of the record. We had an opportunity in your brief to restore context, right?
And I think we did, Judge. We cited to you page after page of his testimony on cross-examination.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Murray. Mr. Roth, how much time do we have? 2 minutes?
In the 2 minutes I have, Judge, I just want to point out in our reply brief, we do take all 19 sites of examination and analyze those. The two places where he gave an explanation, Niles and the Friday incident, are interesting. The Niles incident, very simple to explain. He did come up with an explanation. He said, I put it on the wrong trailer because it wasn't properly labeled. And then he said, but when it came back to the company, you know, maybe somebody at Niles and Granger relabeled the thing so it could go to Kansas City, as if they were in a conspiracy against KNR to ship stuff to Kansas for the same price that they would have had to ship it to Niles. KNR had to make up for the mistake. The problem was, and where his error was, is that the jury believed every word of his testimony. And if the jury believed his fantastic story about what happened at the customer's plant, it would still have to find that he didn't do his job, because he's not allowed to load freight that's not labeled without going to his foreman and saying, what do I do? What should happen? The foreman then comes out with bills of lading, puts it on the freight, and ships it out.
And you had testimony in the record to corroborate that this was indeed the policy of K&R?
That was what, when That was what the union representative testified.
Okay,
the union representative
the
said,
okay.
If it doesn't go with label, that's what you have to do. Now, the union representative was not offered at all to as a material witness to the substance of the charges. He wasn't there to say he made this mistake. He was there simply to say, if these documents are correct, then he is legitimately chargeable. Now, that issue also goes to pretext. It goes to whether or not the hub manager, who is the decision maker, made a decision which he honestly believed was correct. If there are no other questions, Your Honor?
You were going to say something about Friday, Saturday. What Mr. Leonard says was that Filipovich remembered having left at 1:30.
He did leave at 1:30 on Saturday, but the freight was unloaded, or supposed to be unloaded,
on Friday.
I think
Mr. Leonard was suggesting that he remembered that on that, whatever day of the week it was, he remembered having left at 1:30.
He said, his testimony was, my shift was over. I didn't get to that particular piece of freight. Somebody else unloaded that freight. Some other document came on and was responsible for that freight to replace me because my shift's over at 1:30 on Saturday. He had no explanation when the court pointed out to him.
So he was referring to the fact that his shift ends, not that his shift happened to end at 1:30, whatever day of the week that happened to be.
Correct. He said, I know what happened. My shift ends on Saturday at 1:30, so I didn't get to that piece of freight, therefore another document must have gotten to the piece of freight.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Thank you, Your
Honor. Next case for